Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org. This program is recorded from an earlier live broadcast.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. John Adams, the second U.S. president, was first to move into the White House. He wrote a letter that first night there to his wife and close confidant, Abigail Adams, November 2nd, 1800. He described the building in a state to be habitable, but he admitted that it was far from finished. And Adams expressed his hope for its future. He wrote in the close of the letter, "I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and to all that shall therefore inhabit it. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof." This sentiment reflects Adams' desire for the presidency to be a force of good for the nation, but also his view that the power of the presidency could one day fall into the wrong hands, someone without honor. Presidential historian Lindsay Chervinsky has written a new book about John Adams, Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Presidents That Forged the Republic. And Lindsay, welcome to The Source.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So about this letter that John Adams wrote that night, his first night at the White House, wrote it to his wife, really, you know, close confidant, Abigail Adams. But this expression that he has here about the White House and the power and the future of the House and the presidency, what does that tell you?
Well, I love this letter, and there's a reason I chose to feature it at the very end of the book. And I think it's because, well, one, I think it just shows his earnestness, how much he genuinely cared about the Republic and the experiment that was required to make this thing happen. And they really saw it as a family project, a family commitment to the Republic. And so I love that earnestness in him. I love that commitment. I think it also reflects an understanding that the people who are actually in office matter a great deal, because so little of our political system is actually written down. The Constitution is very short. It's one of the shortest in the world. And the Article II, which governs the presidency in particular, is very, very brief. And so that leaves a lot of space for someone to put their own stamp on it. And hopefully that stamp is for good, but it does require a lot of character. It requires a lot of leadership. And after serving 4 years in the presidency, he saw just how badly it could go if you didn't have those characteristics.
I think also this letter shows John Adams' superpower. And I think his superpower was that he was very much aware of the future. He was constantly thinking about the future of this country, while so many at the time were really thinking about short-term objectives. Is that a, you know, I'm just a guy from down the street. I don't know a lot like you, but does that fit?
It does. You know, another way to put it would be that he had really good long-term vision, and he understood that a lot of the squabbles that were taking place that were often making his day-to-day quite miserable, and, you know, shouldn't downplay the nastiness of what that looked like. But he understood that long-term in the nation, it was much more important to focus on the big things, to focus on neutrality, to stay out of war when it was potentially quite damaging, to think about the importance of democratic institutions and the peaceful transfer of power and the survival of the nation rather than his own political aims or his political career. And so I think that long-term vision is something we want all presidents to have, but some have perhaps more than others.
It may also explain why he refused to burn the letters to Abigail that she wanted.
Yes. And as a historian, I am so grateful he was disobedient because, you know, so for example, Martha Washington burnt all of the letters between she and George, with the exception of two or three. And it was not uncommon for people to do so. And thank goodness he did not, because their correspondence is truly a national treasure and makes writing books like this possible.
So being the act that follows George Washington, that, it would have been tough for anyone. I mean, yes or no?
Oh, oh, it would have been miserable for anybody. There was no one in the country that had his stature. I would say actually there's no one that's really ever had his stature. That sounds like hyperbole. That sounds like one of those things where someone says and you're like, well, is that really quite right? But he was called the father of the country before he even came into the presidency. And so whoever came after him was going to have an awful time because they were never going to, you know, match up to his model. They were never going to fare well in any sort of comparison. And if they diverged from his example, they were going to be criticized for doing that as well. So he absolutely knew it was going to be terrible.
And so the question was, could the presidency, could the nation survive without the commanding presence of George Washington? And it was up to Adams to show the people of the country and the world that, this is a system that will work. It doesn't depend upon the power of one individual.
That's right. And I think one of Adams's biggest contributions is just showing up in that moment. It's not as splashy as, you know, winning a civil war or something like that, but sometimes showing up and just being willing to serve when it's not going to go well is so important. And for him, as you said, it was because there was a real question about whether or not this institution, and it's really important that we remember the context at the time, it was primarily a world of monarchies and military dictatorships. And so the concept of a presidency wasn't really something that they saw when they looked around them. And so they were building this new thing. And there was a real question about whether or not it would actually work if you didn't have someone like Washington in that position.
So what was their relationship? Was Washington a mentor to Adams?
No, not at all. They had a respectful relationship. They had known each other for a very long time. John Adams had actually been quite instrumental in ensuring that George Washington was nominated as the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. He was the one that made that happen. Their relationship had soured a little bit during the war because Adams had been critical of some of Washington's choices, and Washington didn't always enjoy criticism and didn't always forgive those that had criticized him publicly. So they weren't on bad terms, but they weren't necessarily close. And initially, when Washington first came into the presidency, he did ask John Adams for some advice, but then quickly distanced himself, I think because Adams had made some choices that Washington thought were maybe not politically very astute, and he didn't really trust Adams's judgment. So Adams sat in the Senate every day as the president of the Senate. He was never invited to a single cabinet meeting. He did not have any sort of major role in any governing decisions. Now, they did see each other all the time because Adams attended the regular social events at the president's house, but that was basically the extent of it. And so when Washington decided that he was going to retire, he did not make any sort of endorsement in the election. He wanted the people to decide. And I don't really blame him for not having Adams in cabinet meetings, but I do blame him for not giving Adams more information that might have been helpful before he entered the presidency.
And of course, the way that the vice president was elected at that time, completely different than it is today. We have the 12th Amendment. So now we have a presidential ticket where the president and the vice president, they come on together. At the time, they were basically rivals, although there was no rival to George Washington. But we'll talk more about their relationship and about how John Adams took the presidency that was left by Washington, and he crystallized the presidency, the precedents that were there, and helped create the White House, the executive branch, the presidency that we have today. And you can call in with your questions and comments. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Lindsay Chervinsky. She is a historian, the executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library. Her new book is Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Presidents That Forged the Nation. She also wrote an award-winning book not long ago that kind of follows, it's like the prequel to this, The Cabinet, George Washington and the Creation of an American Institution. So Washington created the cabinet. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that you do that, but he did it, and he left it for Adams. How did that work out?
Well, I love how you set that up in terms of the cabinet being the prequel. I really think of the books as, okay, so Washington lays this groundwork, and then Adams is tasked with figuring out how it works for everyone else. And the cabinet is a great example because there was no model of, you know, cabinet secretaries giving their pro forma resignation, which is what happens today. There's no expectation that a president would form a new cabinet. That is a lesson that presidents have learned the hard way, that you really want to have your own appointees in those positions. And Adams knew that Washington had had a really hard time finding people to be in his cabinet towards the end of the administration because the positions just were not that prestigious. They were not that well paid. It was, you know, really hard work, and you opened yourself up to criticism, and you were going to spend months away from your family and your home because travel was so difficult. And so he figured, well, if Washington was going to have trouble filling these positions, then he might too. And he didn't have any reason to think that they wouldn't be loyal to the office, and there was no reason to think that he shouldn't keep them. And what he learned, unfortunately, is that some of them, like James McHenry, were very much not up to the demands of the job, and James McHenry was the Secretary of War. Others, like Timothy Pickering, were smart enough, but they were very dispositionally poorly suited to the office. He believed that compromise was a moral failing. He believed he was the smartest person in the room. And those are not really positions you want your Secretary of State to take. And most of them, though not all, but most of them were loyal to Alexander Hamilton first and were really uninterested in serving the president and at times actively undermined his administration, which maybe George Washington didn't know all of, but he certainly knew about McHenry and Pickering's shortcomings and could have told Adams about it.
Well, in your book, you make reference that perhaps Pickering would have been reluctant to double-cross Washington because of his stature.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, a lot of the bad behavior that the cabinet got up to in terms of actively undermining Adams' administration, at times campaigning against him during his reelection, sometimes outright insubordination, none of those things would have happened with Washington because they all, even if they disagreed with Washington, they had such tremendous respect for who he was. He had often been their military commander if they had served in war with him. And so it was just a very different dynamic.
This is a history that was written after January 6th. And so how has that informed the book? There's no Trump or MAGA in the book. I think you do mention January 6th once in the book, but you read it and you can't help but think about things like the bitter political divide that we have today. And people like to say this is an unprecedented time. And well, no, it's not. Actually, this was where in pretty much part of the founding of the nation.
One of the things that I think is so important about history is knowing what is unprecedented and what is not. And that's really useful because it allows us to know how we've gotten through difficult moments in the past. But if something is unprecedented, then that's actually really useful to know because then we can address it accordingly. And so I really did write this book to stand the test of time, hopefully, to not be tied to a current moment. And yet, as I was writing it, there were obvious parallels to me that stood out. It was a moment of very intense partisan division, really nasty political rhetoric, a lot of intra-party fighting, so within various different political factions, questions about citizenship and xenophobia and who belongs and immigration, the threats of political violence, contested elections, foreign interference in elections, pandemics. So, I mean, the parallels are just so numerous and so obvious. And the reason I did mention January 6th once is because it is the answer to the question of why do we need another John Adams book? There are obviously many big and very well-known Adams biographies, but most of them have very little time spent on the presidency. And I think it's because most people, including myself, took the peaceful transfer of power for granted. And if you take it for granted, you might not necessarily look how it was first created or look for the things that the early participants did to ensure that it happened. And so I think those questions, that motivation of trying to understand where this thing came from, really informed my research and informed how I felt like I was making a different contribution than, say, the great books by David McCullough or John Ferling. And so that had to be answered in that way.
So the peaceful transfer of power is significant, part of the contribution that we have from Adams. But he did not attend the inauguration of Jefferson, who was his successor. Why not?
This is a great question. And this is one of those things that I think is so important because it really demonstrates that humans, especially very smart humans like John Adams, are very capable of holding two complex thoughts in their head at one time. So on one hand, John Adams was very upset that he lost. He was bummed that the American people hadn't appreciated what he had to offer to the nation or the sacrifices he had made. And he was mourning his son who had recently died of alcoholism. So he was very sad in a very dark place. And yet, on the other hand, he also knew how close the recent election had come to devolving into horrible violence and the Republic completely falling apart. He hadn't been invited to the inauguration. He didn't know if Jefferson wanted him there. There was no precedent of a president who had lost attending their successor's inauguration. That wasn't started until 1845, and it wasn't in existence at the state level either. And so he, I believe, genuinely worried that his presence would be a distraction, that it would take away from the peaceful transition, that it would somehow take away from the moment, from Jefferson's celebration. And he didn't want to do anything to risk that. And so he left early that morning. He boarded a public stagecoach, which was a very important symbolic gesture because it demonstrated that he was just an average citizen like everyone else. And he left, and then he went home and he wrote Jefferson a letter saying, "Everything looks peaceful here. I wish you a very happy and successful administration." And that is not a small thing to do.
But when Jefferson writes back, he calls him Mr. Adams. Why is that significant?
Well, he calls him Mr. Adams because there's a recognition that once you leave office, you're just an average citizen. And that was really important, especially in a moment where most of the other nations were monarchies and dictatorships, and a person was above the law. And so what Jefferson was recognizing and what Adams had recognized himself is that the presidency is not about one person. It exists separate from any individual. And once that individual leaves the office, they go back to their regular citizen status.
But Adams, when he was president of the Senate, he argued that the president should have a more glorious and magnificent title, your majesty, some type of thing like that. Even though in the Constitution, it says we don't bestow titles of nobility in this country. He made a 40-minute long, passionate speech, saying that we ought to do this, that the title of president wasn't enough. That may have cost him.
Oh, it definitely cost him. It was a very unpopular position. So what he wasn't saying that a president, once they left office, should be a noble. Like, a noble is a title that is almost a property position that is attached to your name and is usually handed down through hereditary lines. He was not advocating for that. What he was saying was, if we call the president something simple like Mr. President, it's not going to instill a lot of respect in this new office, either among the American people or among people who were visiting, who maybe were diplomats, who had been at places like Versailles at the court or the court of St. James in London. He was very worried that people would think that this new nation and this new federal government was this little podunk nothing. And so what he was suggesting is, if you have a fancier title, it might demonstrate to people that this is a powerful office that is worth respecting. But that was very separate from the legal status that he thought people should have once they were no longer in office.
And Washington didn't like Adams trying to push that point of view, and that may have cost him in Washington's view that that Adams was politically astute.
Yes, that's the moment that I think, I mean, the challenge, of course, with writing all of this is that Washington rarely wrote down his feelings, which is really quite annoying as a historian. And so we have to make sort of informed speculation. And it seems that Washington didn't particularly like that position. He was very relieved when Congress settled on Mr. President. And from that point forward, didn't really include Adams in discussions. And so it seems like that is the moment where he thought that maybe Adams had some wild notions.
But back to the idea that once you leave office, you're just a citizen. We have a former president now who likes to use the seal of the president, wants to be declared continues to be the president and recognized and given those honorifics. And that's something that Adams would not appreciate.
That's correct. I mean, I think that they would all recognize in the modern world, there's a need for Secret Service and there's sort of a need for like a elevated treatment for former presidents because of some of the modern complications of the world we live in. But legally, in terms of their status as a citizen, he would be adamant. And I would say, you know, very rarely did the founders agree on anything. But I think on this, they would have been adamant that former presidents are citizens just like everyone else.
And another interesting thing about John Adams, that he was the first civilian to become president. It was General George Washington. He was a military man. But being able to show that this is going to be a government of ruled by civilians, did people see that as new?
Well, it was certainly novel at the time because most of the other nations, the king or the queen or something, they were certainly the head of the armed forces. And our Constitution grapples with this because it does make the president the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, but it also establishes that there's civilian oversight over the military. The military is not a separate political entity. And Adams really struggled with this. One of the big turning points in his presidency and one of the issues he really had to grapple with was the army in 1798 and 1799, when there was a threat of war, and the army had become, this was not the army of today, the army had become very political and was basically being used as a spoil system by the more extreme Federalists. And Adams was very distrusting of that and had to kind of try and figure out how to assert his authority over it while not damaging the nation's security. And that was a really difficult moment because Washington was still alive and Washington had been the commander in chief and Adams had asked him to come back to kind of serve a symbolic role, but an important role for American unity. And that put him in a really untenable position of being stuck between the commander in chief that everyone thought of and his actual role as commander in chief as president.
And Jefferson also was very suspicious of the army and having a navy, and he was forced to recognize that you actually need these things.
Yes, that's right. So Jefferson had more suspicions of the army because Alexander Hamilton was really in control of it. And I think on this area, Jefferson had every reason to be suspicious because Hamilton really kind of wanted to use the army to crush his domestic opponents, which is obviously not something we would consider to be appropriate today. So Hamilton had some really wild ideas about what he could do with the army. The Navy was a little bit different because the Navy, of course, had a defensive purpose, but it also did really important work protecting American trade, which meant that it did really important work benefiting the American economy. If merchants didn't have to pay extreme insurance rates for their goods and their ships, then that was going to improve their chances of turning a profit, which boosted the American economy. So Jefferson had to reluctantly admit that the Navy was actually a really good idea and really quite useful for diplomacy, for national security, and for the American economy.
Just one of many recognitions of his previous positions not being appropriate for real world events for Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, a lot of shade kind of thrown at him in this book. We'll talk more about that when we come back from this break. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. A call in, ask your questions about how we shaped the presidency, what are our expectations, and whether or not those things have been shattered, these norms. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
This program is recorded from an earlier live broadcast.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book, Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Precedents That Forged the Nation. We're joined by the author, presidential historian, Lindsay Travinsky. She's also the executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library. So if you get a question or comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The rivalry between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, of course, legendary, once friends, bitter rivals. They died on the same day. And why were they so adamant, so much hostility between the two?
Well, I think they started to have diverging views of what the American Republic should be. So Jefferson really believed in more of a smaller government, a nation that was really based on agriculture and individual farms. He distrusted cities. He distrusted a lot of trade. He didn't want a big army or a navy, and he was very ideologically aligned with France and had really turned a blind eye to a lot of the damage and a lot of the violence of the French Revolution and distrusted Great Britain a great deal. John Adams was certainly more moderate in his views than some of the other Federalists like Alexander Hamilton, but generally he believed in the importance of a strong navy. He was a little bit more ambivalent on the army. He thought that trade with France and Great Britain was really important, but he distrusted France because of the violence and the anarchy that had come of its revolution. He had a much more sort of realist perspective of foreign policy and understood and believed in the importance of a strong central government. And so they kind of had these diverging views, and then they both came away with a sense that the other had taken the wrong message from their time in Europe. And that would have maybe been okay, except during first sort of towards the end of Washington's presidency and then up through Adams' presidency, their supporters really just said the most vile and awful things about one another in the newspapers. And that was part of the political campaigning process at the time. And that, I think, really drove them apart even more.
So they were so close. Adams just had, what, 3-4 electoral votes more than Thomas Jefferson, so that he was able to become president for that one term right after George Washington. And then Jefferson realized if he was able to get all the electoral votes from Virginia, then he would have won. And then he changed, you know, through persuasion, adopted the winner-take-all system that we now have for electoral college. So if you are mad about the electoral college system the way it is, you might want to think about Thomas Jefferson on that, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, some things are so different in 1800, and then some things are still so much the same. So, you know, Pennsylvania was a major battleground state. And just like then, as in now, each state gets to decide how their electors are chosen, and the states really battled over what that methodology would be to try and come up with the outcome they wanted. And so the Jeffersonian Republicans in Virginia arranged for an electoral process that would benefit them because they had much better organization at the state level. And so they arranged to have ballots that would basically, you had to cast, rather than having like district by district elections, they were going to have statewide elections for these electors. And the rules of the game at the time said that you had to have handwritten ballots with all of the names, but the handwriting didn't have to match the signature. And so the Jeffersonian Republicans had these committees that handwrote all of these ballots and distributed them across the state. And then people could just apply their own signature and hand them in. And it was a brilliant move. And it was a little bit shady, but totally legal. And it worked such that Jefferson and Burr, the other Jeffersonian Republican candidate, won all of the electoral votes from Virginia.
And here we are. So it's very similar to today, you know, questions about voting practices and whether or not things have been toyed with, tinkered or rigged. And did people have those concerns?
They did. I mean, there wasn't like a question of there being an overall fraud or there being votes stolen, but there were questions about sort of like scheming tricks to try and confuse people. So they ran under different names. There was a lot of local campaigning. I think the questions about trickery or or false voting really came more to the front once the elections at the state level had already concluded and it became clear that Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr had tied. And the election then went to the House of Representatives under the terms of the Constitution. And the way that that vote works is each state gets one vote. And so essentially they were deadlocked because neither Jefferson nor Burr had enough states to put themselves over the winning line. And so there was a lot of discussion of various different trickery and machinations behind the scenes to try and get their preferred outcome. So that was, I think, where most of the focus was on what we would call like election fraud.
And then we get the climactic conclusion of a Broadway musical. So, yeah.
We do. I think, you know, I personally love Hamilton. I think it's extraordinary art and it has caused so many people to be so interested in the early Republic, which is such a gift as a historian, especially because people understand that it's art, it's not history. And the number one question I get is, you know, what really happened or tell me more? And that's amazing. And to be sure, Hamilton did play a role. The musical, I think, overstates the role a little bit, but he certainly was a large voice in politics at the time.
Well, wasn't one of the main issues of the election of 1796, with the role of a central bank, if we should have a central bank, which Jefferson was opposed to, and Adams, because he was a Federalist, that he supported?
Well, I don't know that I would say it was necessarily a major issue in the 1796 election. It was certainly it was a big issue in 1792 when the legislation to actually create the bank was being discussed. And it was one of the main turning points in the relationship between Jefferson and Washington and James Madison and Washington, because they were on different sides of that issue. And it came up again and again when the bank's charter had to be renewed, because it would be basically passed for a certain number of years and then it would come up again. And this was one of those areas you alluded to where Jefferson was initially opposed to the bank. And then when he was president, he realized how valuable it was and no longer was in opposition to it and actually found it to be really important.
So how important was it that Adams was a Federalist? Was he a soft Federalist?
He was definitely a moderate Federalist. He was not a party man in the way that a lot of his cabinet members were and some of the other Federalists. And in fact, this is what caused Adams to have such a big rift with Hamilton, is that Hamilton said Adams was too independent and couldn't be controlled, which sounds pretty great to us. Like, we generally want presidents to be independent minded and not, you know, governed by party faction. But Hamilton really wanted to be able to control Adams, and that was not going to happen. And so on some things, to be sure, Adams agreed with the Federalist majority about the Navy. He had agreed with some of the legislation, but on other areas about the importance of diplomacy, concerns about how Americans would respond to taxation or to the army, he definitely differed and definitely tried to carve a middle way that encompassed, I think, both the more moderate Federalist line and also some of the more moderate Jeffersonian Republicans.
And so we got an email question here. What did John Adams and Thomas Paine think about each other? And that's from Kevin.
Oh, they did not think very highly of one another. Well, I think initially Adams recognized the role that Thomas Paine played in churning up public support for independence, but I don't think he thought very highly of Paine's abilities. And as Paine became increasingly radical, Adams was very distrusting of some of those more radical ideas, his criticism of Washington. He had very strong things to say about religion, and that made Adams very uncomfortable, because that sort of almost anarchic perspective was one that Adams was very uncomfortable with. And I think that Paine began to see Adams as a monarchist, which is not totally accurate, but certainly Adams was more conservative than Paine was.
But Adams, you know, he avoided all-out war. We had the quasi-war, an undeclared war, and he told the nation to prepare for a war against France, but yet managed to avoid that. So, you know, how did he manage to navigate these foreign policy challenges?
This was one of the biggest challenges of his presidency, and it was one of the things he was most proud of. Towards the end of his presidency, he said that he would have been happy to have, you know, pursued or achieved peace with France on his tombstone. And that was because he really did have to work for it, and he had to fight against internal forces and external forces. And so he did so in a couple of ways. He did stand up very much for American sovereignty and American independence and American honor when France demanded really inappropriate things to begin diplomacy, like bribes and loans that would be used in a war against Britain, and very embarrassing apologies. Adams had nothing to do with that and refused to participate. He did encourage the slight buildup of an army and the navy as a way to defend the nation if it came to that, but also to strengthen his hand in diplomacy. And he was right to think that way, because once France saw the strong steps that he did take, they really backed off and encouraged Adams to send another peace delegation and said that they would be treated with all due respect as an appropriate, as appropriate of the representatives of an independent nation. And so once Adams had those guarantees, he did send another round of delegates to meet with Paris, to meet in Paris, and they ended up meeting with Napoleon. And that was a moment, that was a huge turning point, because a lot of the Federalists didn't want him to do so because it would undermine the army and some of their political positions. And it ended up being successful. It produced the treaty, which is the longest lasting peace, one of the longest lasting pieces in the world. And I think it was an enormous contribution, and one that he knew would make him unpopular and did anyway, which I think deserves a great deal of political courage.
Peace through strength, from John Adams. We're going to continue our conversation with Lindsay Stravinsky, historian and the new author of the new book, Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Precedents That Forged the Republic. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Back in 1 minute. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, talking about John Adams, his presidency, the second president of the United States, and how he helped form the country. He crystallized what we think about a president, what we expect out of a president. If you've got a question, give us a call, 833-877-8255. Lindsay Stravinsky, when we talk about founding fathers, we have to also talk about the fact that there was slavery at the time. What was John Adams, what was his relationship with slavery?
Well, it was very complicated. Just like most people at the time, slavery was so interwoven with so many aspects of life that it's really hard to distinguish and to separate. He morally objected to slavery as wrong. He felt that it degraded both the enslaved and the enslaver, and it made them both lazy and not motivated to work, and it made them less than, which was obviously something he objected to. He objected to the power that it gave Southern states in Congress and in the Electoral College. He would have won the election of 1800 if not for the three-fifths clause. And yet he also, whenever he was in Philadelphia and he went to the president's house when Washington was president, he would have been served by an enslaved servant or an enslaved valet. So he was surrounded by it. He would have benefited from it in social environments. He, of course, himself never owned anyone who was enslaved, nor did his family, nor did his son. So he and John Quincy Adams were two of the only early presidents who did not own enslaved people. And he and Abigail occasionally had quite enlightened ideas about race. So, for example, they had a young man named James who was a servant in their house in Massachusetts. And Abigail insisted that he receive an education because she believed everyone should be educated. And he was a black man. And so she wanted to send him to the local school, and the teacher and the local families objected to him being in the same classroom. And she went to war with them and made them back down and demanded that he be included in the same room. And she won. So that is a very modern perspective, or at least much more modern than we typically think of. But it is obviously a very messy situation, and they saw it as such.
Let's expand on Adams and his views on education and the right to be educated. I think he has something in there. He wrote the Massachusetts state constitution. That's something that's in there, right?
Yes, he drafted the Massachusetts state constitution, which is a little fun fact, the longest surviving written constitution in the world. the United States Constitution is the longest national surviving constitution in the world. But Massachusetts obviously beats the U.S. one by 8 years. And it really served as the model, or one of the models, for the U.S. Constitution just a few years later. So he believed in the importance of the Constitution. He believed strongly in the need to have an educated citizenry, because he felt that if you didn't have educated citizens, they wouldn't be able to understand the issues, to hold people accountable, to vote in an educated manner, to understand and uphold the sort of values and expectations that were required in a republic, because people set the expectations for their representatives and then have to enforce them. Otherwise, the system would not work. And he wrote quite eloquently about that.
Abigail Adams, his best political advisor, you think?
Oh, by far. So his critics referred to Abigail as his cabinet of one. And this is perhaps one of the most accurate criticisms, because she was always his first and last advisor. In a couple of moments, I think perhaps she encouraged him in the wrong direction, namely the Sedition Act. But mostly she gave really stellar advice that was based in just a real savviness, an ability to understand men and how they operated, and to look around her and assess the political world with real stunning clarity in a way that few other people were able to do, and I think in a way that's really hard to teach. So she was so much more than just a wife or a partner. She was really this incredible political force that so many people sought out for her input. And if anyone, you know, probably most people know the Remember the Ladies letter that she sent him during the revolution, but that was really just the start. And there are so many amazing letters between them.
The Alien and Sedition Act, it's seen as one of the big blemishes on John Adams' presidency. Yet he said he didn't really enforce it. He never deported anyone. It seems kind of like today the version of shutting down TikTok, because the accusation that all this foreign interference is happening in the country today. And what about that comparison?
Well, I think the bills are, there's actually four bills. There were two alien acts. There was a naturalization bill that made it harder to become a citizen. And there was the sedition bill. He didn't ask for any of them. He didn't curry support for any of them or whip votes, but he did sign them all. And the naturalization bill made it much harder for immigrants to become citizens, because immigrants tended to support the Jeffersonians in elections. And so the Federalists wanted to undercut their support. The Alien Friends Act was designed to allow the president to basically deport anyone at will. And Adams never used that power. So it gave him enormous leeway, and he never used it. So I think that's an important note. The Alien Enemy Act basically said if there was a war declared, then citizens of foreign nations with whom the United States was at war could be removed with appropriate due process. And there has been a bill like that one on the books basically since. It's a very normal wartime measure. And it was, because war was never declared, then it was never invoked. The Sedition Act is a little bit more complicated. Adams, again, he didn't ask for it. He didn't curry support for it, but he did accept it. And he did accept and sometimes appreciate the prosecutions, because I think it's so important to note, you know, today we have jurisdiction, or we have jurisprudence, that says you are not allowed, or you are not protected from speech that basically allows you to invoke violence. So that is not protected speech. There was no such provision on the books, and newspaper editors were genuinely encouraging and invoking violence. And so I think there was a real fundamental good faith fear of violence that was coming from the speech, not perhaps unlike the foreign interference fear with TikTok. But the bill's response was to basically make it illegal to criticize the president or Congress, or to encourage opposition to any of their bills, which is obviously a violation of the First Amendment. And so I do think that it is a mark against Adams' administration. I don't think he deserves quite as much blame as perhaps the Federalists in Congress, but nonetheless, it was not a good bill. And I think in terms of TikTok, it's hard to say, because the bill is not actually shutting it down. It's saying that it has to be owned by an American company, but that's obviously a very messy process as well.
Right. The idea that there was such a political divide in the country at the time, and that they were saying that there was influence coming from abroad, was that actually happening?
Well, yes and no. So, I mean, there were these huge waves of immigrants that were coming in, and some of them really were quite radical. So, a lot of the immigrants that were coming in from, for example, Ireland were fleeing Ireland and Great Britain because they had tried to stage an unsuccessful revolution, and they wanted to continue to fund that revolution, and they often did form armed militias to potentially fight or assist in fighting. And so, it was they had sort of reason to be uncomfortable. I'm not sure that they're the Federalist concerns that there was like this big French plot that was in cahoots with the Democratic Republicans to basically take down the government. That might have been overstated a little bit.
So the France was not paying for newspapers or pamphlets to be printed in the United States at the time, during a war of influence.
Well, France was absolutely participating in the newspaper war, but I think a war of words was quite different than what they envisioned, which was actually a physical war, and they thought that France was actually going to support these militias at home to overturn the government. And so, war of words, yes. Actual physical violence, perhaps no.
So, as Adams' presidency helped establish the foundation for the American presidency that we know now, and his experiences and decisions shaped the office's role in, foreign policy, domestic affairs, party politics, he was very much involved in the creation of partisan politics, wasn't he? And the idea originally was that we would try to avoid that.
He was, the thing is he didn't really see himself as a party man. He didn't see himself as beholden to the Federalist Party first and foremost, and he really didn't like the partisan politics. Now, that doesn't mean that he wasn't willing to participate in them, but he was among that early class that felt like they were bad and criticized them and tried to sort of avoid them, but also recognized that they were kind of happening anyway. And so I think he was disappointed that they had become as nasty as they did. He worried that they would pull apart the nation. And he did believe that Americans had more in common than they did different that separated them. And he hoped that they would remember those things, just as Washington had hoped and had said as much in his farewell address.
And in his farewell, when Adams returned to his farm in Quincy, Massachusetts, did he just retire and avoid public life, or what was his next act?
Pretty much. I mean, he loved being a farmer. He loved his farm. And so he did spend most of his time doing that. He did a little bit of public writing, especially later on. He tried to sort of combat some of the slander that had been set out against him, especially by like Alexander Hamilton. He sent, once he and Thomas Jefferson re-engaged with their friendship starting in 1812, they sent letters back and forth. So he kept up a very busy correspondence. And occasionally he would do things with like local militias or local groups in Boston. But by and large, he remained private.
And we ran out of time, but quickly, was he held in high esteem, or was he just sort of seen as the other guy?
He locally was held in high esteem. Massachusetts people generally tended to celebrate him. And he was respected as the former president, but he was not ever worshipped in the same way that Jefferson or Washington were.
Lindsay Travinsky is the author of John Adams and the Precedents That Forged the Republic, Making the Presidency. Thanks. So good talking to you about John Adams today, Lindsay. So good. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.